This program is brought to you by PersonalLifeMedia.com. This is part one of a two-part program.
My name is Meredith Medland, and you're listening to Living Green. You're going to be excited to hear a two-part episode. So this is part one of two parts, and we're about to hear from Brent Kessel. From a very young age, Brent Kessel was fascinated with money, yet he knew that there was more to life. So he studied economics, psychology, meditation, and Ashtanga yoga, but wanted to provide holistic financial advice. Since 1989, Brent has counseled multimillionaires as well as people of modest means to create a balanced and more fulfilling relationship to their wealth. In part one, we're going to learn about the eight financial archetypes. We're going to learn about what it means to be living green financially. And you're going to hear lots of really cool ways that you can impact your financial success through these exercises that are related to living green. So I hope you enjoy this part one. We'll go right into it. Then stay tuned for part two. You'll also notice that there's a PDF file attached to this podcast. There are three exercises that Brent put together that I thought would be really valuable for you. So thank you so much for listening to Living Green. And here we go, right into part one.
Many, many times there's actually a strong aversion to money. There's been some injury or pain created around money, usually early in life, sometimes adolescence, that has made money synonymous with pain. To me, money is completely neutral. It has no characteristic unto itself. All it is a social agreement. And if you were the only human being in the world, money is irrelevant. It doesn't exist. It's only a means of exchange and a means of communication. So all the stuff we put on it is we have to put that stuff on ourselves and on humanity as a whole. It's got nothing to do with money itself.
Brent, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Meredith. It's good to be with you.
All right. So I'd love to learn about these eight archetypes.
You know, I wasn't intending to create archetypes when I set out to write this book for HarperCollins, but it just became clear to me as I started writing the stories down of my clients, myself, my workshop participants, that people tended to group in these kind of universal clusters of behavior with money. And I thought that we really could learn so much from not only the others in our own archetype, but also those in opposite archetypes. First, the ones in our own archetype, just because, you know, we can really see and feel that we're not alone. I mean, it's one of the biggest tragedies of money in the Western world today, or America especially, is that it's this private thing. It's so linked to survival that people feel very ashamed to admit that what they don't know. And I think, you know, I'm in a sort of privileged position that I get to see the inner workings of many, many hundreds of people's relationships to money. And honestly, I've got clients that are hundreds of thousands in debt, and I've got clients with hundreds of millions of dollars of positive net worth. And the inner experience is much more similar than different. So I created these archetypes, and I'll just kind of go through them one by one and give you just a very short sort of snapshot of what each one does. And before I do that, I just want to say that, you know, this isn't meant as some kind of typing system or to make anybody feel wrong or labeled or incomplete. I tend to focus on what is imbalanced about each of the archetypes primarily, because then it helps us recognize that in ourselves and see how we might create more balance and what it is that isn't working in our relationship to money. But every archetype has a gift as well as a pitfall, as we'll see. And I can come back to this at the end of the listing and talk about what the gifts are a little bit.
That sounds really good. Now, just so everyone knows, Brent's book is coming out in January of 2008 with HarperCollins. It's called It's Not About the Money. And here we go. Let's hear about these archetypes.
Okay, great. So the first one is what I call the guardian. And the guardian really is prudent, but is also often quite anxious, concerned about money. And this can be whether they have plenty of money or not plenty of money. The hallmark of the guardian is just excessive worry and anxiety about money, and it can manifest as, you know, staying up to 2-3 in the morning worrying. It can manifest as seeing the stack of bills and the adrenaline rush through the body and sort of the heartbeat picking up the pace. But it's really, you know, it's just money has become somewhat synonymous with anxiety and worry. So that's what I call the guardian.
Now, is there a way that you can characterize people or types of people that you've seen in the green space in any of these? Can you add in any stories for us?
That's a great invitation. I think there certainly will be a couple of archetypes that many more people in the green space fall into, but there's a guardian version of the green social activist, which is the person that is extremely anxious on a physiological, emotional level about global warming, about, you know, whatever environmental issues are most concerning to them. And so, you know, at its most imbalanced state, it becomes a form of handicap or liability almost, that there is so much resentment or so much contraction or so much just paralysis that they actually can't be a very effective activist.
So I see this, actually. I was at the Lojas 11 that was in Southern California here. And one of the things that I noticed was there were activists who were having upset about some of the people who were making more money and using their brand in the green space. So that would be an example of what you're speaking about, right?
Yes. That's a classic green space, you know, or you could call it hippie, or you could call it Lojasian response to money. I guess I'll jump ahead. This is a little different order than I usually do, but that archetype is what I call the idealist. And so the idealist is someone who prioritizes either spiritual growth or creative pursuits or social activism above making money. And many, many times there's actually a strong aversion to money. There's been some injury or pain created around money, usually early in life, sometimes adolescence, that has made money synonymous with pain, with what you don't want to deal with. And it might be just, you know, lack. You know, my family didn't have as much money as the neighbors, the other kids at school, and I had this shame about the clothes I wore or the car we drove, or it might be very real lack of we couldn't afford to buy groceries and I actually went hungry, you know, for X amount of my childhood, and it's unfair. And what I was told is that it's because the rich have as much money as they do, or it's because of corporate greed, or it's because of this or that. And it would be so much more fair to have, you know, a more equitable playing field, or, you know, people's values are just screwed up. And that's why I had this pain.
Now, at the end of your listing out of the 8 archetypes, I'm going to come back to this one and ask you about that, because I feel that if we have some ideas on how to heal or mend or move through this archetype, that there'll be a lot of progress made in the movement.
I think so, too, and I look forward to coming back. I mean, that's what I do in the book, is there's 35 exercises that people can actually do for themselves on their own financial lives and emotional lives. And so in the idealist chapter, you know, there's a handful of exercises that one can actually sit down and do some journaling, some guided meditations.
Excellent. Can you share one right now?
You know, I think the biggest one for the idealist is looking inside to see if the aversion to money is really serving your cause. Idealists are often very inspiring, very visionary people, you know, and have been throughout history really, really important, because when a society kind of gets too much on one track, you know, that track tends to die off. And so to have the sort of dynamic debate and, you know, and be constantly challenged by social critics, it requires these idealistic types of people. But the problem is, you know, or the problem can be, if that idealism turns sort of bitter, and there's a negative, there's an against response in the body. The real question is that againstness serving your cause? Is it, you know, are you able to, I mean, you look at, you know, the classic, I mean, I know everybody talks about them, but the classic social activists, Mandela and Gandhi and Dalai Lama and those people, and I feel that the hallmark is that there isn't an againstness. Gandhi wasn't against the British. He was for Indian rights. And it's like, it's a very different thing on an energy level. So with money, my contention would be, I've got clients who are incredibly socially active and have done some incredible things, you know, in microfinance and, you know, in environmental preservation. And they've done it because they haven't been against money. Or I shouldn't say because, but a part of their effectiveness has been that they've worked through that againstness that they may have created for themselves in the 60s and 70s and gotten to a point where they're comfortable having enough money or more than enough money, and they've used that surplus to then advance their cause, whether the cause is green or painting great paintings. So that's the guardian. Another archetype is called the pleasure seeker. This is probably what green folks, you know, most despise in America. It's Madison Avenue. It's shopping. It's retail therapy. It's give me what's going to make me feel good now. And, you know, again, I'm speaking at the imbalance level. Pleasure seeking is great. And there are many idealists and, you know, many guardians that could use more of it and really just enjoying what life has to give us, you know, on a sensory level. And some of that takes money. Some of it doesn't.
So we've got the guardian, the idealist, and the pleasure seeker for our top three.
Those are the first three, and not in any particular order. That's just kind of how we're going. The saver is another one. So the saver is your classic millionaire next door. It's the person who's frugal. You know, at the imbalance level, it's the miser. It's the person who's already got way more than they could ever need, and yet they're still counting pennies and, you know, being extremely frugal with family members and often really wanting to impose their values on other people. And in the green space, I'll try and make a parallel here. I think these are, you know, the great conservationists. These are the people that are trying to figure out if they can live off the grid. These are the people that are trying to figure out how small an impact they can make on the resources of the planet. A saver is doing exactly the same thing, but only with money. And it's not driven from the same motivation. It's driven from a motivation usually of personal security. So again, there's often a survival fear with this archetype, and the way I'm going to survive is by saving my money, having enough money, not overspending. Next, I'll go to the innocent. The innocent is not too dissimilar from the idealist, but there isn't often as much of an aversion to money as there is with the idealist, and there isn't necessarily a creative or social or spiritual pursuit that is the primary driver. The innocent tends to just feel like life will work out just fine even if I don't pay much attention to money. So there's a certain faith component to innocence. There is often a naivete or an avoidance. It's sort of like, I don't really want to balance my checkbook because I just don't want to know. It, you know, it does bring up pain when I see that there's a lack. It does, you know, I'd rather just be doing whatever else it is in life that I like doing. So there's more of an avoidance than an aversion, and a certain faith that goes along with it that it'll all just work out even if I don't pay attention. So again, coming back to sort of the green or spiritual or hippie sort of population, these are the classic kinds of have faith and God will provide. You know, there's an abundance of stuff, and you know, there's no reason that I should be in lack other than what's between my own ears.
Now let's talk about that for a minute before we go into the archetypes. So I'm familiar with a lot of languaging in 12-step programs that puts whatever the program is about, you know, food, sex, money, smoking, marijuana, whatever it is, puts that higher of a value than money. So if you keep these things in order, the money will flow. It's what you just said. So I've seen that witnessed there. I've seen people with really deep beliefs where they get down to their last pennies knowing like the universe will provide, and it usually does. But I wonder, maybe would it have provided even more abundantly had they not made four choices prior to that? So I've heard that. The second thing that I wanted to comment on when you were talking about the other archetypes were the idea of safety and that money equals safety, which I've personally learned isn't actually true, or that's not my opinion. And I've heard many of my teachers and mentors share that with me as a complete illusion. So let's take a look at those two ideas as you go on to the other archetypes and see how those play out as well, please.
Okay. Yeah, I'll just say that with all of these, I think that money isn't complete safety, and yet it is a part of safety. So what you find is that a lot of idealists and innocents will say money isn't safety, and that's part of the rationalization for I don't need to deal with it, and I can avoid it. But while the universe may provide for them, the way in which it usually provides is they take a job that they hate, or they become codependent with a spouse or, you know, a parent or some other family member, or on the social, you know, system, the social economic system, welfare, whatever. And, you know, that creates a tremendous amount of just sort of pain usually.
So just to make sure I know what you mean. So that might be someone saying, hey, I'm going to ride my bike because riding my bike is green. But the reality is there's not a responsibility being taken around their car. So it becomes a kind of like a, what do you call the things on horses? A blinder for what's really going on in their relationship to money gets hidden through green values or morals.
Yeah, I would agree. I mean, to me, money is completely neutral. It has no characteristic unto itself. It's just, all it is a social agreement. And if you were the only human being in the world, money is irrelevant. It doesn't exist. It's only a means of exchange and a means of communication. So all the stuff we put on it is, we have to put that stuff on ourselves and on humanity as a whole. It's got nothing to do with money itself. Money does tremendous good in the world and does tremendous evil in the world. You know, and it's so almost any thought we can have or any belief we can believe about money is partially true. And it's really valuable to recognize that, because whatever stories you're telling yourself about money tend to be believed wholeheartedly. This is what's true 100%. Now, I'm sure you could say the same thing about, you know, environmental activism. I haven't looked at it as closely, but, you know, there's partial truths in everything. And so finding, especially with money, the way in which what I'm telling myself is not true is really important, but equally important is to not then jump to the opposite truth and say, oh, okay, I've been telling myself money is safety, and now I've just learned money isn't safety. So I'm just going to live a great, free, impulsive, spontaneous life. You're going to end up a pleasure seeker, you know, one of the other archetypes that's sort of out of money. And you're like, oh, God, that didn't work. Now I'm back to being a saver.
So you're just telling me this is another one of the middle ground Buddha philosophies. It's always the middle.
That's right. Chapter 11 of the book is called The Middle Way with Money. So you nailed it. So, yeah, moving on, we'll go to the caretaker next. I think we've done five: guardian, pleasure seeker, idealist, saver, and innocent. The caretaker, in a way, many people in the Green Movement probably amplify the caretaker's attributes. The caretaker really puts others' needs ahead of her own. And in my work, it's really around money. So it's either supporting charities or causes with an imbalanced amount of money. So giving so much away that you're actually hurting yourself. More often, though, it's a child, an adult child living at home. It's a parent. It's a spouse. It's actual caretaking behavior, enabling behavior. Just, you know, this person can't do it without me. And so I'm going to, you know, I'm just going to do what I have to do. And sometimes there's truth in that. More often than not, there isn't. You know, there's some truth in it, but there's not as much truth, meaning in the person's dependency. That we think, caretakers tend to think, this person would just be ruined if I didn't take care of them in this way. And whatever fear we have about them and about, you know, and whatever need we have to feel like the provider doesn't let us test that belief out. Meaning, let's try scaling back the support 10-20% next month and see what happens. See how resourceful this person can actually get. It's like need is the mother of invention. If you don't allow there to be any need, you won't see what the inventiveness might be.
Oh, I got to tell our listeners that I'm laughing right now, because I've actually had that personal experience where I went on my sort of 7-year spiritual journey out of the corporate world and was climbing back, and my dad kind of cut off the borrowing funds and said, you know, there's just figure it out from here. And boy, was I motivated after that. I mean, I was never, you know, taking care of my dad like with a trust fund or something, any extreme like that, but $1,000 here or there. And when that cut off, boy, everything escalated and I started having many more of my dreams. So I highly recommend that.
Yeah, it's great. And again, I mean, just to some of your listeners who might have real dependent people, you know, people who can't be resourceful for themselves. It's not to say that the right relationship is always a financially independent relationship. Again, money is this means of exchange and support, and there's plenty of relationships that should have a one-way financial flow. It's just figuring out, am I imbalanced in this relationship or not? Am I giving this person as much opportunity to thrive as I can, you know, as they could take advantage of or not? And if I'm not, what's motivating that? You know, what is it about me that either needs to be the provider, needs to not let them down, needs to not be seen by others in society a certain way, and really just questioning, you know, ourselves inside as to what's motivating this particular behavior.
We're about to take a break, but when we come back from the break, we're going to talk about relationship to money as one of the key components of what it means to be living green. So you want to stay tuned for that. But before we go to break, let's hear the rest of the archetypes.
Just two more. So the next one is the star. And the star is someone who seeks recognition or attention through their use of money. Might be how they dress, might be the car they drive, might be wanting their name on a particular gift to a charitable cause. It's, you know, I want the juice. I want the attention. I want, you know, people to see me a certain way. And for many in the green movement, it can be voluntary simplicity. I want to be seen as making almost no impact. I want to be seen as living on very little. I want to be seen driving a Prius. I want to be seen in particular ways. And again, nothing wrong with any of this. It's just understanding it and knowing how we're using money in certain ways so that we get a sense of choice about it and don't have this feeling. I mean, so many people have just sort of been shamed from a young age that, you know, this is the right way with money and that's the wrong way with money. And we believe that we're really, really caught, you know, in a particular archetype, in a particular relationship to it. And we're not, you know, if we're willing to look inside. So the last one is the empire builder. And the empire builder is the archetype who uses innovation and decisiveness and often workaholism to really create something of enduring value. I mean, you could say Bono is an empire builder right now with the One campaign. Certainly Oprah and, you know, many business people, Bill Gates, Warren Buffett, are empire builders. Most empire builders are involved in business, you know, in creating a business of enduring value. But, you know, I would say that land conservators are empire builders. You want to leave something better than you found it, and you're willing to sacrifice a lot of personal energy and, you know, of balance often, which is what I'm pointing people's attention to, is are you losing a balanced relationship to life and all the things that fulfill you in life in order to fulfill this dream of some legacy? And is it worth it?
So all about balance and the middle way. These are very familiar concepts to me. So Brent tells me that one of the things that he knows that everyone else may not know is that almost everyone you see, whether they're wealthy, successful, or homeless, has a similar level of mental noise about money, love, and how to create a better future for themselves as well as everyone else. So when we come back from the break, Brent, we're going to let you tell us about what it means to you to be living green and see if you can inspire all of us to be a little more financial in our greenbacks and make that feel more imbalanced and walk that middle road.
Listen to Living Dialogues, thought leaders in transforming ourselves and our global community, with Duncan Campbell, visionary conversationalist, bringing you the best in new paradigm thinking on personallifemedia.com.
Welcome back to Living Green. My name is Meredith Medland, and I'm here with Brent Kessel, and we're about to hear what it means to be living green financially and walk in the middle way.
Thank you. It's good to be back. You know, I think for me, living green really involves having a sense of choice in our relationships to money and the world. But what I've seen is that so many people are stuck in a particular behavior pattern for decade after decade. And it doesn't even matter if they get a big windfall. I mean, there's a couple of statistics that might be interesting to just mention, that 78% of NFL players are divorced, bankrupt, or unemployed within 2 years of their last game. 33% of lottery winners file bankruptcy at some point after they're winning. And I'm not talking about $5,000 winners. These are like the big jackpot winners. And what that tells me is that, you know, nothing against lottery winners or NFL players, but that people return to the relationship to money that they're unconsciously most comfortable with. Whatever they think unconsciously they're entitled to, or, you know, sort of that the nervous system is oriented towards, is what they will manifest regardless of what changes in the outside world. You know, which is why so much attention is put on abundance thinking and, you know, changing the unconscious thoughts you tell yourself in order to change your outer circumstance. And I certainly agree with that. It's not, I don't think abundance is the right thing for everybody. So I don't, that's not my particular angle. But I mean, many savers and empire builders need less abundance and need more joy in their lives and more caretaking and giving, compassion and generosity. So, I mean, I think to me, I know we've been talking about the archetypes, but to me, living green is about living in this very balanced way amongst all these archetypes. Because if you could do that, I mean, who wouldn't want to be the person who is, you know, has a sense of self-sufficiency like the saver, and a sense of compassion and generosity like the caretaker, and a sense of innovation and, you know, vision like the empire builder, and, you know, a sense of kind of idealism and holistic view of the planet like the idealist, and a sense of sensory enjoyment like the pleasure seeker. You know, it's none of these are bad, you know, just in and of themselves. They're only bad if we become over-believers or evangelists, you know, of their point of view to the exclusion of all the others. And my feeling has been, and my experience in my own life has been, that I've become a much more effective activist and philanthropist the more balanced I've become amongst all these archetypes, and a more effective business person.
One of the things that I really loved is in preparation for our interview, I did a lending loan with Kiva.org. That's Kiva.org. And I'm sure many of our listeners have heard of Kiva. And what it did for me is it put my relationship to money and the things that I have and what I'm up to in great context to be able to sponsor a woman who's in Mexico just trying to buy fruits and vegetables for her grocery stand. Made some of my the things that I think about money and preparing for this interview a bit, well, very ridiculous, you know, in the grand scheme of things. So can you talk a little bit about Kiva and some of the other opportunities that are available, and then touch a bit on green investing?
Yeah, I'd love to. I mean, obviously that's what I'm passionate about and spend my career doing. But first, I just want to say, to your point, that so many of us will do that. We'll sort of see the ridiculousness of the American problems, if you will. Like, oh God, I can't afford the blouse I really want, or I can't, you know, I can't get into the $25,000 car, so I'm going to buy the $22,000 car. And what I just want to caution you about is not, for yourself and for your listeners, is, again, we tend to be very punitive around money. There's a very kind of strong should voice, superego, parental authority voice in our heads about money. And God, I can't believe you're whining like this again. And look at the problems that other people in the world have. And you're, you know, you're essentially complaining about something that's not worthy of complaint, is kind of the tone of that inner authority. And I just want to say that my experience has been, when we approach ourselves that way, it's hopeless. Because what we've essentially done is said to our inner four-year-old child, you're not entitled to your feelings. You're not. It's throwing a tantrum. At one level, it's throwing a tantrum all the time. And how can I get more of what I want? How can I avoid pain? And you're saying, you know, essentially, be quiet. You don't know what you're talking about. And everything you thought was right is wrong. And anyone who's a parent knows that that just doesn't work with a four-year-old, and it doesn't work with ourselves either. So I just want to first say that, you know, it's so important to have a tremendous amount of compassion and a tremendous amount of, you know, stepping carefully as we start to navigate this inner territory. So in your example, you deserve wonderful congratulations for doing this, you know, for going to Kiva and meeting this woman through this amazing venue and supporting her in the way you're supporting her. And it's that kind of sort of positive focus on doing something constructive that begins to break down the unconsciousness that is inherent in all these archetypes.
Thanks for saying that. And one of the things, I've been listening to a podcast, an NLP podcast on money, which has been fantastic. And the focus is all about when you're in the transaction of money, to make sure that the energy that you give to that money, much like you would a prayer before a meal or a relationship to food or tantric sex or whatever it is, that there's also an acknowledgement of the offering in the transaction that's occurring, so that that energy moves forward.
Yeah, sounds great. It's not my expertise, but it, again, I think money's just a store of all the human beings that touch it. And so this really leads into your question to me, which is, how can you actually invest more greenly, and how can you, you know, use money in a way that really supports what you want to support? And there's really two classic examples that I'll give. One is on the investment side of things. You know, we really like to invest in as broad and interconnected a way as possible. So what that means to me is that, coming back, every spiritual tradition in the world that I've studied has at its core the understanding that we're all one, that all of humanity and all of life really is an interconnected expression of something. God, the divine soul, just consciousness. The physicists, you know, the most agnostic physicist in the world, still can't define consciousness. And, you know, so what is this thing that makes us alive? And, you know, most people who've practiced some form of spiritual practice or seeking for some time have had a direct personal experience of that being very interconnected with everyone else. And the word yoga literally means unite or to yoke together. And, you know, that is what a physical yoga practice is, as well as a meditation practice. So what do you do with your money to further that understanding? What we do is we build portfolios that invest in over 11,000 companies all over the world. So we're not trying to guess as to whether Microsoft's going to do better than Lotus or, you know, who the next sort of great company is going to be. We're investing in every public company, essentially, so that they might be in Indonesia and they might be in Arkansas, and we don't really care. We're sort of agnostic, to reuse that word, with respect to where, you know, the company is. What we're not agnostic to is people that are actually harming other human beings or harming the environment with our money. And so we withhold our capital from tobacco companies, from environmental polluters, and we proactively put some more money into companies that have great workplace environments or, you know, are going carbon neutral, doing things like that, that are really pro the environment.
Now, how common is this? Are there tons of investment firms doing this? Is this easy? Are there a lot of green 401k options now, or how unique is your offering?
It's not that common. I mean, the typical 401k does not have a green option in it, and the typical investment portfolio doesn't have a green option in it. That's not to say that socially responsible or what we call sustainable investment choices aren't out there. There are plenty. I mean, there's probably about 1,000 mutual funds out there that you can choose from. We think that our offering is quite unique because most of the offerings that are out there have a couple of problems with them, and it's kind of beyond the scope of this, you know, the topic we're covering today, but they just tend to be too expensive. They tend to be too focused on one particular class of stocks, like large U.S. companies, for example. And they tend to rely on a manager who is picking stocks rather than spreading it out all over the world, essentially, like we do. For those who might know, it's, you know, our way is called indexing or passive investing. The typical way, when I say typical, I mean probably 99% of the funds you'll find out there, especially on the social or green side, is where a stock picker is picking stocks, and they call that active investing as opposed to passive or indexing. So what we think is unique is that we are indexing the green space. And there are a couple other index funds out there, and we're just trying to sort of take it to the next level of doing it globally, doing it with all kinds of stocks, small stocks, value stocks, et cetera, et cetera.
And how long have you been creating investing around green and sustainable companies?
The green sustainable part started about 4 years ago, and we actually started our company, Cubera Portfolios, specifically to help people with much lower levels of assets than can usually get personal portfolio management. So now it goes all the way down to 75,000. So we started that about 3 years ago, a little over 3 years ago, and our three-year performance has really, it's been very gratifying because it's proved what we thought, that you can actually implement your social values and have better financial returns than investors who aren't implementing social values. Used to be the conventional wisdom was you've got to give something up financially to invest green. And it was true of most of the options, and it's still true of many of the options. But this three-year period, we've had 47% returns at Cubera in our stock portfolio, our green stock portfolio, versus the average green mutual fund at about 31%. And the S&P 500, the largest 500 companies here, also around 31%. So, you know, 3 years is not a particularly long time in investing circles, but we've studied 70 years of data to create this portfolio, and we think that it's going to continue to outperform.
Now, and this is great. I mean, listeners, you can go to the episode page, which is at personallifemedia.com. You can click on the left-hand rail on Living Green, and you'll see Brent's episode page, and there's a whole bunch of links that he put together, which will help you get to his website and some of the other websites and touch on some of the things that we're speaking about, as well as a bio, so you can get in touch with Brent if you need to. Thanks again for listening to Living Green. You can find episode 2 next week with Brent Kessel. Remember, this was episode 1 of a 2-part series. He's going to be talking to me next week about what it means to be living green financially. And we're going to review 2 specific case studies on eco-entrepreneurs who are trying to bring their idea into the world. Thanks again for tuning in. You can always find out more at personallifemedia.com. Check out my blog, go ahead and make some comments or pop me an email, and I'd love to be in correspondence with you. Thanks again for listening to Living Green.
This concludes part 1. The interview will be continued in the next episode of this show.
Find more great shows like this on personallifemedia.com.